Yes, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm very happy to introduce Richard Amesbury, Chair and Professor of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Clemson University, South Carolina. Before moving to South Carolina, he was Professor of Theological Ethics at the University of Zurich, Switzerland. And I have a list of some of his books here, which has been kindly provided for me. Morality and Social Criticism, The Force of Reasons in Discursive Practice, 2005. Faith and Human Rights, Christianity and the Global Struggle for Human Dignity. And that was co-authored with my former colleague, George Newlands, 2008. And finally, Was ist theologische Ethik? Co-edited with Christoph Amann, 2015. And today, Rich will speak on religion and secularity in the philosophy of religion. So let's welcome him.
Recently, philosophy of religion had been organized around an agenda framed by Western modernity, which reflected the preoccupations primarily of Christians and their secularist critics. The object of this largely ahistorical endeavor was a God possessing the attributes of omnipotence, omniscience, and moral perfection, who, in an apparent gesture toward inclusivity, was said to belong to the tradition of classical theism. Philosophy of religion was the discipline that sought to determine whether such a God exists, whether propositions about this God are meaningful, and whether it is rational to believe in this God, especially given the reality of evil. Although philosophy of religion was not exclusively the property of Christians, its agenda was decisively shaped by Christianity, and it frequently had an apologetic flavor. In parts of Europe, philosophy of religion has long been considered a branch not of philosophy per se, but of systematic theology, and in the United States, it is often housed in religion departments. Occasionally, to be sure, philosophy of religion took up the problem of plurality, a discussion which has until recently been framed in terms of the competing approaches of exclusivism, inclusivism, and religious pluralism. But the problem of other religions was almost invariably approached from the standpoint of the Western Christian theist. The central question here was whether the claims of other faiths serve to undercut those of one's home tradition, or, on the contrary, could be relativized in such a way as to shore up a noumenal religious real against the claims of atheist secularism. This kind of philosophy of religion still exists. Indeed, it arguably remains dominant, structuring undergraduate courses and textbooks, and exerting considerable pull in professional conferences and journals. But it is, I think, in decline, and this for several reasons. One is that by distancing itself from the wider philosophical conversation, it became isolated and moribund. Another is that by pursuing a largely apologetic Christian agenda, it has come to be looked upon, rightly or wrongly, with suspicion within the academy, perceived as out of step with prevailing norms of serious inquiry. A third reason is a more mundane consequence of the first two, namely the paucity of academic jobs in this field. In addition to these external pressures, however, developments internal to philosophy of religion are reshaping the field. In particular, a range of scholars, including those here, many of them trained in both philosophy and the academic study of religion and conversant with post-colonial studies, has sought to broaden the field beyond the parochial preoccupations of recent decades, bringing philosophical analysis to bear on a much wider, more diverse range of religious phenomena, including those outside Western theism. The latter projects take various forms, but they agree that philosophy of religion must be reconceived if it is to flourish as an intellectually respectable discipline with a future in the academy. A particularly strong version of this argument is laid out in Wesley Wildman's 2010 book, Religious Philosophy as Multidisciplinary Comparative Inquiry, Envisioning a Future for the Philosophy of Religion. Partly a critique of what he calls traditional philosophy of religion, and partly a manifesto for an alternative, Wildman's book makes a case for what he calls religious philosophy, a term chosen deliberately to establish a distinction with what commonly trades under the name philosophy of religion. Quote, I shall call this multifaceted venture religious philosophy in parallel with the phrase religious studies. Neither is a religious venture as such, but both take religion to be the object of study, end quote. Religious philosophy, on Wildman's account, is not a discipline, but rather a container for a variety of multidisciplinary comparative inquiries. Taking its bearings from religious studies, whose goals and practices it shares, and to which it makes unique contributions, religious philosophy is a secular project, consistent with the norms of academic inquiry of the modern university. The adjective religious characterizes its subject matter, not its methods. Religious philosophy, as Wildman conceives it, shares with religious studies the goal of understanding, quote, religion as such, not merely what one given discipline can comprehend of religion, but religion as a whole in all its intricate variations and manifestations, end quote. There is much to be said in favor of broadening the scope of philosophy of religion, whatever term we choose to describe the field so reconceived. There are, however, worries too. One of these concerns the idea that what makes the field a field is, inter alia, a shared subject matter, namely religion, investigated in its complexity by multiple disciplines. That religion can play this unifying role is an assumption that has been challenged, ironically, by religious studies itself, which over the past decade or two has taken a reflexive turn toward a critical examination of its own categories, including the category of religion. So religion, it turns out, is a comparatively recent innovation, or more precisely, what religion means today is not what the term or its analogs used to mean. On the contemporary popular understanding, religion names a sphere of society or of individual life, which is analytically distinguishable from so-called secular domains, such as the state and the market. As a matter most fundamentally of belief, religion is ideally, if not always actually, private. So conceived, religion is a human universal, a dimension of what it means to be a person and an ingredient in every great civilization. But it takes many forms, the most significant of which are the world religions. Scholars of the category's history disagree as to precisely when the term acquired its modern meaning, which is not surprising given that the composite sketch just offered comprises a number of different lineaments. Tomoko Masuzawa has argued that the concept of world religions, which has grown over time to include some 11 or so great traditions, is a product of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. By contrast, the idea that religion is separable from politics and the state developed in the early modern period, and the emphasis on belief, with its corresponding deprecation of ritual and material culture, is arguably attributable in part to Protestant theology. In antiquity, the term religio was used quite differently, in reference to binding duties, including but not limited to cultic rites. In On True Religion, Augustine used the term to mean worship. As William Kavanagh points out, quote, Augustine's subject is not Christianity as a or the true religion, alongside other religions understood as systematic sets of propositions and rites, end quote. Rather, true religion for Augustine is worship of the triune God. As recently as the late Middle Ages, the word religion was used infrequently and never in the quasi-sociological sense with which we are today familiar. Even in the early modern period, the convention was to speak not of religions like Judaism and Islam, but of peoples like Jews and Mohammedans, as Muslims were often characterized by Christian writers. Precisely how these usages changed is the subject of a growing and impressive body of contemporary scholarship, which seeks to understand the complex relationship between discourse about religion and the practices to which that discourse belongs. Shifts in the latter, the Protestant Reformation, the rise of nation states, colonialism, etc., enabled new conceptual developments, but the latter, in turn, helped to bring into existence new social realities. Commenting on these developments, the anthropologist Talal Asad famously concluded that, quote, there cannot be a universal definition of religion, not only because its constituent elements and relationships are historically specific, but because that definition is itself the historical product of discursive practices, processes, end quote. Religion, on this view, is not a timeless, universal phenomenon for which modernity has at last bequeathed us a name. Rather, it is itself a distinctively modern Western formation. Indeed, Daniel de Buisson suggests that religion is, quote, the West's most characteristic concept, around which it has established and developed its identity, while at the same time defining its way of conceiving humankind and the world, end quote. A product of the West, religion came, ironically, to be associated above all with the East, as characterizing that which was not Europe. Paradoxically, those lacking the concept were assumed to be the most religious, deprived of the sort of critical distance necessary to wrestle religion into view as a discrete, limited phenomenon. If people in the advanced, differentiated, secularized societies of Europe and North America had religions, people in other parts of the world were had by them, their subjectivities and social institutions awaiting emancipation from religion's all-pervasive and despotic grip. Orientalist discourses about religion thus helped to underwrite the colonial encounters of the 18th and 19th centuries. To be fully modern, a society needed to circumscribe and contain religion, disentangling it from knowledge and power, and making of it a repository of wisdom and value on which individuals could electively draw for inspiration, guidance, and moral orientation. Distance from this ideal was a measure of cultural backwardness. By means of these encounters, the concept of religion found its way into novel cultural contexts, where it was taken up in ways that contributed to the disciplining and remaking of the larger social world. Whether celebrated or lamented, tolerated or feared, the world religions with which we are today familiar, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Jainism, Sikhism, Confucianism, Taoism, Shinto, are assumed to be tokens of the same type, species of a common genus. One reason it might be argued that we're apt to discover family resemblances among the world religions is that only those phenomena have been allowed to count as religious or to merit the honorific world, which conform to roughly Protestant criteria of true piety. When religions transgress these boundaries, when, for example, they are perceived to be too political or to take an unseemly interest in money, they are said to be mixing illicitly with the secular. the empirical argument for essential similarity among the so-called world religions would seem, in other words, to draw covertly upon a stipulative definition of religion that disqualifies disconfirming evidence ab initio. To be sure, every category has a history, and to subject a concept to genealogical analysis is not necessarily to criticize or reject it, as though we were discontent with anything less than eternal forms. But such analyses can shed light on the regimes of power to which knowledge belongs, which can in turn prompt reflection on the role our own work as scholars plays in reproducing these regimes and or putting them in question. Genealogy is thus an exercise in taking responsibility. To appreciate the point of these critiques is not necessarily to deny that religion, sans quotation marks, is real. Here, an analogy with critical race theory might be helpful. Racial categories, like religious ones, are culturally constructed, contextual, contingent. But race is real in the sense that the employment of these categories has real effects in the world. To attempt to counter these effects simply by rejecting the category, so to pretend to be colorblind, would in many cases only re-entrench prevailing racialized dynamics of power. Similarly, it can be observed that the closely related category of religion, with which the category of race has been co-constituted, has taken on a life of its own. It is entrenched not simply in scholarship, but also in law, public discourse, the broader liberal imaginary, and, as noted above, has been appropriated well beyond the contexts of its origins, remaking other cultures, and in turn being remade through this contact. So it's too late in the day to simply abandon the field. Claiming, disclaiming, granting, and refusing the status of religion are inherently political acts, as arguably is failing to acknowledge it. The reality of religion, like that of race, is revealed in the lives to which this discourse belongs. The discursive practices anchor the reality. As a result, though, religion and race are inherently contestable. Their reality does not prevent the revision of our practices. Indeed, it might be thought to demand it. New approaches to philosophy of religion seek to move the field beyond the preoccupations of Christian theology and philosophical theism toward an appreciation of a fuller range of religious phenomena. But if the concept of religion is itself the product of extrapolation from modern Western Christian understandings, does the new philosophy of religion, in its ambition to do justice to the whole range of religion, simply reproduce the deficiencies of the old under the guise of a universalizing, albeit particularistic, category? And does the effort to conform to the secular canons of the modern university, to approach religion, as it were, from outside, reinscribe the boundaries of religion as a discrete phenomenon? To put it the other way around, does the identification of specific phenomena as religious, and so as suitable topics for philosophers of religion, presuppose and thus leave unexamined a distinctive regime of knowledge, the secular, which ought itself to be put in question? The critique of the category of religion is sometimes confused with an anti-theological polemic. That this is so is ironic, because it is partly by means of the category of religion that theology has come to be contained and marginalized. Yet, in the work of certain scholars, thinking, for instance, of Russell McCutcheon, criticism of the category of religion has been pressed into the service of a reductive social scientific agenda. According to this view, religion is not sui generis. Rather, it can be disaggregated into a variety of mundane phenomena, each of which is susceptible to social scientific explanation. I don't have time today to assess this social scientific approach, but wish simply to point out that it is not entailed by the genealogical critique described briefly above. which is a critique of the category of religion, not necessarily of the things so categorized. The possibility of theology does not depend upon the category of religion or the claim that religion is sui generis. To be sure, the critique of religion might serve to undercut certain versions of liberal theology or religious pluralism, but it is not an inherently anti-theological project. Indeed, there's only the history of theologians criticizing the category of religion for theological reasons. It's thus curious to find certain scholars in religious studies seeking to erase the boundary around religion while reinscribing it methodologically. By insisting upon the secularity of their project and treating their research subjects as data rather than as interlocutors. Occasionally, writers in this vein will acknowledge the legitimacy in principle of other epistemological frameworks and ways of knowing. They will claim, however, that these are not scholarship. Here, scholarship seems to play a role analogous to that played in German language academic discourse by Wissenschaft, i.e. the role of establishing and policing a boundary between what belongs in the university and what does not. Yet it is notoriously difficult to justify this boundary, which is largely the result of shifting historical contingencies, political dynamics, and cultural settlements. As with other claims to neutrality and objectivity, appeals to the scientificness of secular inquiry ought to be greeted with considerable suspicion as tools of ideological legitimation. The identification of the critique of the category of religion with a deflationary anti-theological agenda has understandably created the impression among some philosophers of religion that it ought to be resisted. However, these two projects are distinct, and the latter is not entailed by the former. So I wish to argue that a much more fruitful line of inquiry involves pairing the study of the cultural history of religion with a corresponding analysis of the larger imaginary within which the term functions, the background against which religion can be identified as an object of interest, anxiety, regulation, and academic study. We might call this background the secular, if we're careful to note the ways in which this use of the term, as a name for this frame of reference, differs from its use within that frame, where it denotes, inter alia, the non-religious. So the secular is not the absence of religion, but, on the contrary, the regime of knowledge within which religion emerges into view as a discrete topos. It is an episteme, an ensemble of attitudes, dispositions, affects, and ethical intuitions that structures knowledge. So understood, the secular must be distinguished from the different but related concepts of secularism, an anti-religious ideology, and secularity, a political strategy for the containment and management of religion. These latter concepts are themselves secular, insofar as they presuppose the distinction between religion and non-religion. But it's important to appreciate that one need not be a secularist in order to be secular. On the contrary, to advocate on behalf of religion is a characteristically secular endeavor. Religion is a secular category. The secular is intertwined with and homologous to certain other cultural formations, such as racial whiteness, which function as culturally constructed but naturalized defaults in relation to which difference is configured and managed. As Vincent Lloyd has recently put the point, quote, whiteness is secular and the secular is white. The unmarked racial category and the unmarked religious category jointly mark their others. Or, put another way, the desire to stand outside religion and the desire to stand outside race are complementary delusions, for the seemingly outside is in fact the hegemonic, end quote. A similar point can be made about maleness relative to gender and heterosexuality relative to sexuality. these hegemonic defaults are co-constituted and mutually reinforcing. And it's worth noting in this connection that secularity, like philosophy itself, tends to be associated with rationality and contrasted to religious irrationalism and emotion. What might it require to get the secular into view as an object of philosophical analysis, to reposition it as a topic of, rather than the unquestioned context for inquiry? In a provocative article in the current issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, entitled "Deprovincializing Philosophy of Religion," Jacob Holsinger Sherman argues for both the revaluation of non-Western ways of knowing and a contextualizing and relativizing of the secular episteme central to Western scholarship on difference. Quote, "It's not enough merely to give a charitable ear to a supposedly emic other," he writes. "One must also contextualize, politicize, and historically situate supposedly neutral and universal etic perspectives at the same time," end quote. Calling attention to the dominance within the Western Academy of what he refers to as, quote, "normative secularity," the active and unabashed privileging of etic perspectives, especially the privileging of naturalist etic perspectives, end quote, Sherman advocates moving beyond the naturalizing, historicizing perspective of the secular study of religion toward an appreciation of various emic perspectives, a move which requires acknowledging those outside the secular episteme as conversation partners, not methodologically mute data. He writes, "When we consider emic epistemologies, we will perforce often reconsider epistemologies from outside the modern West. While some may think this is a kind of anachronism or a romanticizing of the past, there is indeed something very modern about considering a vast diversity of spiritual and religious options. In revaluing emic perspectives, philosophers of religion are not involved in a kind of regression to a time when one or another version of theology unproblematically dominated the sciences or even explained all religious phenomena. Instead, this revaluation simply points to the fact that Western secular epistemologies may not be the best or final arbiters in the assessment of religious knowledge claims, in particular those emerging from long-term habituated religious or contemplative practice," end quote. So I'm in full agreement with Sherman on the need not simply to expand the range of possibilities over which philosophy of religion extends its gaze, but also to challenge the normativity of the secular gaze itself. To put this another way, it's not simply the religion in philosophy of religion that needs pluralizing, but also the philosophy. Indeed, it's worth noting, as Richard King has pointed out, that non-Western thought has historically often been branded religion by Western scholars, thus obviating the need for Western philosophers to engage with it as philosophy. Ironically, in expanding the category of religion to include non-Western thought, without also pluralizing philosophy itself, we risk barring these so-called non-Western religious thinkers from the role of philosophical interlocutors. I would like here, however, to suggest some additional nuances to Sherman's characterization of what this endeavor to deprovincialize philosophy of religion demands. First, while the secular regime of knowledge certainly aspires to hegemony, it's not clear that it always succeeds. Leaving the distinction between the secular West and its non-secular others fuzzier than is sometimes assumed. Secular regime of knowledge is moreover fraught with paradox and tension, bearing within itself the traces of what it aspires to exclude, and thus already destabilized from within. Provincializing the secular is not simply a matter of bringing one internally consistent point of view into encounter with others, but of opening it to suppressed possibilities latent in itself. Indeed, these fissures are what allow the encounter with difference to amount to something more than a standoff. Second, provincializing the secular is not merely a matter of adding it to our now expanded repertoire of religious topics, alongside other forms of what Sherman calls habituated religious or contemplative practice. Indeed, because the secular is the regime of knowledge that allows us to speak of religion as a distinct topic, loosening its grip on philosophy will necessarily have the effect not only of pluralizing our subject matter, but also of pluralizing the way that subject matter is framed. Making the strange familiar and the familiar strange will, in other words, complicate the categories in terms of which we configure difference. So it's not by emphasizing religion or broadening its extension, but by attempting to think otherwise that one can challenge the normativity of the secular. And third, because the secular is, among other things, a mode of temporality, which functions to maintain a certain understanding of the modern, relativizing the secular will problematize the idea that philosophy of religion aspires to be modern and can vindicate itself through appeal to its modernity. Rather than attempting to defend the modernity of philosophy's methods, I would rather put in question the epistemic assumptions that give the objection of anachronism its purchase. So how might we then go about softening the secular up from within in such a way as to gain critical philosophical purchase on its concepts and grammar? So I don't believe there's any single answer to this question, in part because the secular is not one thing, but an ensemble of them. What I'd like to offer here is a series of interrelated reflections from a standpoint that's itself rather secular. So this is not a standpoint I've chosen to adopt, or which I can simply renounce. Rather, it's the one I find myself within. Yet, as I've suggested, the secular is not so consistent and all-pervasive as to render hopeless every attempt from within it to think against its grain, to think not simply with it, but about it. So here I'd like to consider some remarks of Foucault's from his lectures on the birth of biopolitics. In these lectures, Foucault sets out to examine government as, quote, the exercise of political sovereignty, end quote. Yet, he says, he's interested not in how governors really governed, but rather in, quote, the way in which this practice that consists in governing was conceptualized, both within and outside government. For Foucault, quote, choosing to talk about or to start from governmental practice is obviously and explicitly a way of not taking as primary, original, and already, as a primary, original, and already given object, notions such as the sovereign, sovereignty, the people, subjects, the state, and civil society. That is to say, all those universals employed by sociological analysis, historical analysis, and political philosophy in order to account for real governmental practice, end quote. He writes, for my part, I would like to do exactly the opposite, and starting from this practice as it is given, but at the same time as it reflects on itself and is rationalized, show how certain things, state and society, sovereign and subjects, etc., were actually able to be formed. In other words, instead of deducing concrete phenomena from universals, or instead of starting with universals as an obligatory grid of intelligibility for certain practices, I would like to start with these concrete practices and, as it were, pass the universals through the grid of these practices, end quote. So Foucault's project aims to liberate history from the categories in which it has hitherto been analyzed. He writes, I start from the theoretical and methodological decision that consists in saying, let's suppose that universals do not exist. And then I put the question to history and historians, how can you write history if you do not accept a priori the existence of things like the state, society, the sovereign, and subjects, end quote. So we might call Foucault's approach methodological nominalism. It's a topic to which he promises to return later in the lectures, but does not. What he does say, however, suggests a starting point in thinking about the secular. If religion is a secular category, and indeed a defining one, then one strategy for gaining critical distance on the secular might be to ask how history, or indeed philosophy of religion, might be written and organized about this concept. Now, it's sometimes asked why the category of religion should be singled out for special critique, given that all categories have histories and it's impossible to write history without the use of historical concepts. For example, Assad's claim that a universal definition of religion is impossible because any such definition is itself the result of historical discursive processes might be faulted for setting an impossibly high bar. What definition is not the product of history? Similarly, after having canvassed the difficulties with the term religion, Timothy Fitzgerald suggests that we might turn instead to the concept of culture. But this suggestion appears not to fully appreciate the problems with the latter concept. For Foucault, methodological nominalism is a general strategy applicable to any organizing category, even if it is necessary to rely on some categories while analyzing others. Best conceived as a method rather than a substantive claim, it is premised not on a discontent with general categories per se, but on the recognition of their historical contingency and an interest in the conditions of their production. But my interest in applying Foucault's method to the category of religion is strategic. So one answer to the objection that all categories have histories, many of them problematic, is that the justification for focusing on religion is that it is central to the secular in a way that other concepts are not. What explains the interest in this particular category is not that it is unlike other categories in having a history, but that it plays a central role in the episteme under examination, the secular. Now, though much can be gained by thinking historically about our concepts, there's a philosophical difficulty here, having to do with the fact that historical time, the imminent progression of efficient causes, is itself entangled with the secular. So like religion, the term secular has undergone important shifts in meaning. Whereas an earlier use of the term, which is preserved, for example, in the Italian and Portuguese terms for century, denoted the temporal structure of chronology as distinct from eternity and kairotic time, secularity today tends to be conceived spatially, as the shared domain of publicity from which religion is excluded, the negative space of religion as a distinct phenomenon. As the earlier distinction between the secular and the eternal faded from view, secularity re-emerged temporally as history, the homogeneous progression of events within what Charles Taylor calls the imminent frame. Bereft of any obvious contrast case, secularity as temporal structure was rendered virtually invisible by virtue of being naturalized, thereby allowing the label secular to be transferred into the domain of space. In its self-sufficiency, history is conceived as a domain of facticity, the neutral baseline for adjudicating religious difference. As Saba Mahmoud observes, quote, secularity flattens religious incommensurability, forcing religious traditions to confront one another in the uniform space of history, all equally vulnerable to the questioning power of the secular, end quote. To call history secular, to thematize it as part of a distinctive and contestable, if hegemonic, imaginary, is to recognize that discourse about religion and its others belongs to a particular epoch, while acknowledging the paradox and methodological inadequacy of attempting to historicize history itself. I've argued elsewhere that understandings of time are always implicated in practices and institutions, and that secular time, what Walter Benjamin called homogeneous empty time, is maintained by and in turn helps to underwrite the institutions of the state and the market. As Reinhard Kosalek has pointed out, the flattening of time allowed the early modern state to establish its authority on the basis of inductive inference and rational prediction, and to undercut rival claims to authority grounded in prophecy, apocalypse, and what Taylor calls higher times. He writes, quote, the genesis of the absolutist state is accompanied by a sporadic struggle against all manner of religious and political predictions, The state enforced a monopoly on the control of the future by suppressing apocalyptic and astrological readings of the future. In doing so, it assumed a function of the old church for anti-church objectives, end quote. The state, in turn, helps to enforce the long run that functions as the horizon for monetarism, the economic policy underlying what's popularly described as neoliberalism. By regulating the money supply, the state stabilizes these horizons, creating conditions for profit, growth, and economic progress. Interestingly, this long run of the market is sometimes described as secular, as, for example, when Larry Summers warned in 2013 against what he called secular stagnation, a gradual slowing of GDP growth. So here the term is being used in its classical temporal sense. Within this secular temporal imaginary, religion is positioned as belonging essentially to the past. A modern category, religion is, for modernity, a perennial anachronism. Coming into view only as it is perceived to be receding, it is imagined as most pervasive, precisely where it is not identified as such. Masazawa writes, quote, when religion came to be identified as such, that is, more or less in the same sense that we think of it today, it came to be recognized above all as something that, in the opinions of many self-consciously modern Europeans, was in the process of disappearing from their midst, or, if not altogether disappearing, becoming circumscribed in such a way that it was finally discernible as a distinct and limited phenomenon, end quote. Religion, that is to say its putative historical displacement, belongs to the deep mythology of the secular episteme. It is what makes modernity modern. So recent efforts to historicize the secular, while well-intentioned, have the curious effect of reaffirming this secular temporal imaginary. Is there a way of decentering and contextualizing secular time that does not consist in attempting to place it within itself? Here we're confronted with what I take to be the central challenge in the study of the secular, namely the problem of framing. To be made sense of as an object of study and critique in the way that religion is an object within the secular episteme, the secular regime of knowledge would need to be framed by something other than itself. It would have to be grasped from the point of view of some outer limit. But because religion and history are both constituent elements of the secular imaginary, neither can provide this outer limit. Moreover, depending on how one understands the relation between the frame and what is framed by it, the search for ever wider frames of reference itself poses a logical puzzle, setting up a regress of frames of frames. The secular frames religion, but what frames the secular, and what frames that frame, etc. The theory of framing proposed in anthropology by Gregory Bateson and Irving Goffman borrows its imagery from the way a frame on a wall directs the viewer's attention to the painting within. It presupposes a distinction between outside and inside. This distinction has in turn been fundamental to the self-understanding of the academic study of religion, which typically prides itself on taking the etic perspective, in this way distinguishing itself from theology of various kinds. It is this ostensibly privileged vantage point of the framer that constitutes its secularity. As Bruce Lincoln puts the point in Thesis 1 of his Theses on Method, quote, the conjunction of that joins the two nouns in the disciplinary ethnonym history of religions is not neutral filler, rather it announces a proprietary claim and a relation of encompassment. History is the method and religion the object of study, end quote. So the frame here stands above what it frames and dictates the terms in which the latter is to be understood. Indeed, Lincoln concludes that, quote, when one permits those whom one studies to define the terms in which they will be understood, one has ceased to function as a historian or scholar, end quote. From the perspective of anyone conversant in postcolonial theory, these claims are, I think, bound to be worrying. But it's helpful to have them so plainly and unapologetically laid bare. Lincoln suggests that, quote, the ideological products and operations of other societies afford invaluable opportunities to the would-be student of ideology, end quote, and that the tough-minded scholar ought not to pull any critical punches owing to, quote, the guilty conscience of Western imperialism, end quote. But it's striking that the method articulated in his theses affords the scholar's research subjects no opportunity to talk back. The framing is entirely one-directional, and what they say is of interest only within the scholar's frame, not relevant to it methodologically. Somewhat ironically, the privileged perspective claimed by the historian or scholar of religion might also be seen to mirror in its basic structure that once claimed by theology. Its gaze, like that of the divine, is proprietary and encompassing, and it need not explain itself to those over whom it extends its dominion. In a discussion of Bateson's theory of framing, the anthropologist Don Handelman notes that hierarchical understandings of framing are, in fact, nothing new. He writes the ancient Hebrew cosmos, the first of the surviving monotheisms, during a lengthy period came to postulate an absolute rupture, an utter discontinuity between God the Creator and human beings, creating a binary of absolute difference yet similarity. God first created man in his image, and then changed this similitude. God, the cosmic encompassment, is outside his cosmos, holding the entirety of the cosmos together from outside itself. Human being cannot penetrate the paradox that separates him or her from God, end quote. The problem with the secular, one might say, is not that it decenters theology, but that it usurps its throne, establishing itself as the epistemic center of the universe. The central conceit of the secular is that it is the frame of frames, the neutral, objective vantage point, the view from nowhere. To the extent that it is precisely this conceit that needs to be challenged, and not the secular perspective qua perspective, it would appear that what is required is not a superior perspective, a more secular form of the secular, but rather a way of decentering and contextualizing the secular that does not pretend to neutrality. A perspective that does not simply interrogate, but allows itself to be interrogated by what it seeks to understand. Handelman contrasts lineal framing, which is, quote, highly directive and directional, its flow one way from a meta level of organization to whatever the meta level subsumes, end quote, with an alternative cognitive topography, which he describes as Möbius framing. Quote, this deceptively simple topological conundrum is constituted by a single surface, which is both outside and inside, external and internal to itself. He's thinking of the Möbius strip. Perceived as framing, the Möbius ring is inherently in movement, continuously relating exterior to interior and vice versa. There is no hard and fast lineal separation between frame and content, end quote. Although Handelman is interested in ritual and play, I would suggest that his reflections on framing point us toward a useful model for thinking about the unique contributions philosophy of religion might make to the study of religion and of the secular. A philosophy of religion that aspires to be cross-cultural and multi-religious need not commit itself to either the etic perspective of the secular study of religion or the emic perspective of theology or analogous critical practices in non-theistic traditions. Or rather, it might commit itself to both. Conceived as a sort of Möbius loop, philosophy of religion is not a third thing, a wider or higher perspective, but a practice of mutual critical encompassment, which comprises movements in both directions. So conceived, philosophy offers no cool place, no vantage point above encounter. Rather, it is a practice of reciprocal inframing of frames, a form of what Wildman calls multidisciplinary comparative inquiry, albeit one that continuously subverts attempts at establishing epistemological hierarchies, including those of both Christian theism and the secular. Thanks.